You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 3rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, if not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We're back, day two after vacation, still rusty, but still with a great program for you today. Author Guy Lawson on giving us a little background on the way that Mexican drug cartels and the financial industry work hand in glove. Also, some updates on those pot-smoking arms dealers, the biggest small arms dealers in U.S. history, I think it was. They had the biggest deal. We'll be talking to Guy shortly. Also on the program today, current, no longer current. They've been sold. They're going off the air. Will be replaced by Al Jazeera English. We'll talk about that. America, I guess. Also, proposals to arm teachers gaining strength in Ohio. And Representative Peter King does an about-face as John Bonaire promises to maybe give some funding for Sandy. We'll get to that Dick Armey story at FreedomWorks just because it's too perfect. And more on that fiscal cliff deal. And really about how it's being reported and sold to the left. But before we get to that, ladies and gentlemen, today, as we speak, during this program, the 113th, is that it? Congress will be sworn in, and some people will be leaving. It's a great day. Elizabeth Warren, will be sworn in. Tammy Baldwin, a markedly more liberal Senate, hopefully, and also in the House as well. Alan Grayson's heading back. Chris Murphy from Connecticut will be replacing a man, and I'm so excited to be able to say his name, hopefully just one last time. Joe Lieberman will be leaving us. Just a little bit of a recap of this guy's career. As a young man, Joe Lieberman, probably a douchebag, and certainly as a senator he was, and now he's leaving. We probably won't have to mention his name again until his name comes up in some story about him lobbying for some insurance company or doing something of that ilk. But I have disliked Joe Lieberman for longer than I've been on the radio, so much so that even back in 2000, following the election, I wrote a, well, I had a character based on his fake son. Apparently he does have a son or two, I don't know. But there was a character that I was doing, Joe Lieberman's son, which I ended up making a movie around it, a strange movie that got even stranger with the events after 9/11, which, of course, actually is available as a swag if you become a member of the Majority Report. But that's not what we're talking about. Joe Lieberman, there was a one of the high watermarks of the Netroots, I think, was in not only in their promoting a primary of Joe Lieberman, because I think that was going to happen anyways, but I think it was indicative that the Netroots, at least at that time, was a bellwether, a reflection of what was happening on the ground with activists. I was, I consider it, I still am very proud about the fact that Ned Lamont announced that he was going to run against Joe Lieberman before his official announcement on the Friday before the Monday in which he officially announced. When I was filling in for Randy Rhodes, I invited him on the program, and he announced that he was, in fact, going to run against Joe Lieberman. Sadly, Ned Lamont was not the guy to knock him off in the general election, but he did basically perform an invaluable function, which was to make it clear that Joe Lieberman was not our friend, was not a Democrat. That notion of the left primarying people who were a problem in the Democratic caucus, I think, is hopefully something we're going to see more in the future. To force the Democratic Party to the left, we just don't have enough pressure on them. And as we talk about the way that the fiscal deal waged by the crafted by the president, as we talk about the way that's being reported by left of center types, we'll talk about why that's a problem. But so I'm very, very pleased today to say goodbye to Joe Lieberman. Do not let the door hit you. Well, actually, you know what? Let the door hit you on the way out. Let the door hit you on the way out. May you trip down the steps on the way outside of the Capitol building. May you get into your car and find out that it has no gas or that it won't start. When you get back on your private jet or your corporate sponsored jet to go back to Connecticut, may you find that it has that inclement weather keeps you on the tarmac for hours and that the bathroom is not functioning in the plane. Then when you get home to Hartford, may you be stuck in a traffic jam for what's left of that industry in creating traffic in downtown Hartford. And then after that, peace be with you. Enjoy.
Well, when you get home, I hope the heat doesn't work either.
Well, that would be nice. But I'm not going to ask for the world. So, Joe Lieberman, I hope Fox invites you back on TV every now and then. But I doubt that they will. And so I'm glad that you will no longer have any relevance because I just don't like you. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Guy Lawson. I don't know how to make that more poetic, but I feel pretty good about it.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back my good friend and incredibly successful author of The Octopus, Guy Lawson. Or actually, Octopus, isn't it?
It's just Octopus, yeah. The Sam Israel, I'd say the Sam Israel, the secret market, and the world's wildest con.
And we will have a link up on the blog where one might purchase that book. We've talked about it at length. In fact, we replayed the interview where we talked about the book in our best of, because people enjoyed the story so much. I want to talk about that, just a follow up a little bit.
Yeah.
That and the other story that we had talked to you about in the past, about those teenage arms dealers. But before we do, one of the last shows of 2012 that we did live was talking about the HSBC fine, I guess, that they got, or settlement, or they had to pay $6 billion for laundering drug money over the course of what seems at least 15 years. Making anywhere up around $9 billion. So, you know, if you got to kick back 10-15% on your revenue, that's not a bad deal. And they laundered a tremendous amount of Mexican drug cartel money. And I don't know if you're aware of this, Guy, but you wrote some blockbuster pieces for Rolling Stone magazine back in the late aughts. In 2009, 2008, for Rolling Stone, about the Mexican drug wars.
Yeah, I do recall that very well. In fact, they kept sending me back to Mexico so often, I was getting addicted to the tacos and the nachos. I covered it in three different feature articles and looked at it from three different angles. One, sort of from the how the cartels operate on a kind of operational levels, and I went to this place called Sinaloa, which is the sort of the home base of the old school cartels. Then I went to Mexico City and examined how it worked, the drug industry worked on the political level, how it was entwined with the Mexican establishment and government. And then the last article I did was how they operate in the United States, which it ties into the HSBC story, which is, you know, I started reporting that last piece thinking that I was going to uncover this incipient kind of rising violence inside the United States. And I went to Alabama because there had been a quintuple homicide that looked like it was cartel related. And, you know, guys like Anderson Cooper were sort of henny penny, the sky is falling, the Mexicans are coming. There was all this sort of hysteria in Arizona. You might recall that moment in the late aughts. And what I discovered, to my surprise, but then of course it makes perfect sense, is that the Mexicans don't have much in the way of violence. There's some spillover, but very little, because they're really operating a business, and it would be bad for business to bring their disputation north of the border. So like this HSBC thing, you know, they really operate much more like vertically integrated international corporations than the Tony Montana cliche.
Right.
Which is,
go ahead.
You know, the idea that the Mexicans are this, you know, they are out of control, crazy cartel people, and they do horrendously violent things. But at their core, they are a multi-billion-dollar industry the size of the airline industry. And so, of course, they need bankers, and they need to invest their money, and they send their good kids to good schools. And you know, what you'll see in Mexico emerging in the next few years is you'll see the Mexicans basically stopping to fight this ridiculous war on drugs. That's after the disaster of the last 6 years of the hot war that they've had in Mexico. The political climate has changed, and people are just fed up with it.
And so, I mean, before we get to that, because, I mean, that's interesting, and I guess it seems to me that once something like that happens, these cartels don't go away. They just become, I guess, more legitimate and less violent, right? I mean, is that basically what happens? I mean, it's sort of like
What happened in a useful analogy is the organized crime in the United States, the mafia. Okay, so the mafia had this long-term sort of understanding with law enforcement. They didn't kill people in the street. You know, there was just things they didn't do. And then in the 1980s, suddenly the mafia sprang to this huge prominence, And it seemed kind of mysterious why it was all falling apart. Rudolph Giuliani will tell you it was because of his incredibly brave RICO prosecutions, but he's, as with everything else, not being straight. Well, what happened was...
I find that so hard
gambling.
To believe. Rudy has saved us all.
They legalized gambling, right? And so all of a sudden you had all these casinos around New York City, you had the lottery, and that was a main piece of the revenue. That was about half the revenue of organized crime. And when they lost that, they all started fighting. And then the leading guys got killed, and the dummies like John Gotti came up behind, and you had chaos. It's pretty similar in the Mexican context, but marijuana, which is this cash cow for the Mexicans, has not been legalized, quote-unquote legalized, in any kind of massive way the way that gambling has. I was reading a piece today just before I came on, Sam, about this the idea of what legalizing pot would do to the Mexican cartels. And some guy was remarking, well, I actually wrote it down. Someone from RAND and a former White House drug official were saying that pot really isn't the problem and that legalizing it won't do anything to hurt the cartels, which is just the biggest load of hooey you can imagine. It's the establishment's way of ensuring that the sort of that law enforcement continues to have its, you know, its hegemony, the DEA continues to perform the way it does. It just perpetuates the idiocy. So, you know, in my view, this beginning movement of legalization through the states is probably the most hopeful thing for Mexico that you could imagine.
That's interesting. Now, I mean, what is their argument? That they simply say, well, if it's not pot, then they're going to start to import some other drug? Or what is the argument that they say that if you were to somehow make – you were to take out the premium, the massive premium, I mean, you know – marijuana is not expensive to grow in and of itself. If it was legal, it would be, you know, it's a weed.
It's a moral and a political argument disguised as a practical, insight. It's because they don't want people to have pot. You know, at its root, there is no, you know, what on earth are you going to say?
But what is their argument that if you were to actually make it legal, that it wouldn't basically defund these cartels? I mean, they're getting a massive...
To misrepresent the facts, Sam. The only way you can make that argument is to be disingenuous, right? To say that you're going to remove some significant piece of revenue from an organized crime or cartels, from these cartels, and say that's not going to hurt them, well, it just doesn't add up. So the HSBC thing, what that really illustrates is the vast amount of money being made by these cartels, and that's like a drop in the bucket.
Right.
And then when you marry that with the fine, you know, I did another little thing before I came on, and I think that Goldman Sachs in itself, which is in itself, in my view, borderline an organized crime organization, is going to make $6 billion. What was HSBC's profits? They're as you said, they're paying a tax to continue practicing a lucrative business.
Right. I mean, it's just the cost of doing business. You know, on my podcast, I got to pay for bandwidth. I got to pay for people's downloads. It's just one of the line items that if I knew how to make a budget, that I would include in my budget.
Yeah. The Manhattan Southern, the United States Attorney for the Southern District put out a press release yesterday saying that they'd had record seizures, financial and criminal and civil seizures this year, like $3.5 billion. And, you know, I don't know what, compared to what Wall Street gets through front-running and cheating and insider trading, I mean, I don't know if that's like a tenth of a point.
Right.
A point? Maybe it's 2 points. Maybe it's like, you know, they're kind of like a hedge fund fee, two and 20 or something. It's not a significant, I mean, it sounds big and great and everything, but when you compare it with what's at stake, with these cartels and of course on Wall Street, not to say they're the same thing because there's different issues at stake, obviously. But the amount of money involved for these financial institutions is so vast that law enforcement is kind of a joke.
So when these guys launder this money, like what is the level of awareness? I mean, obviously the reports, you know, out of that HSBC story were that the cartels had actually constructed money carrying boxes that conformed to the distance between the counter and the sort of the glass partition, so they could just slide it easily underneath, you know, and have the most amount of money. I mean, it's an incredibly It's an incredible, sort of, I guess, sign of efficiency. But if you need to do that, you're just bringing in so much money.
So what's the financial institution? What money laundering effectively consists of is the effort to create a plausible defense that you lack specific knowledge, plausible deniability. But put it another way, in a criminal context, money crimes almost always require specific intent. You need to know that it's dirty, right. And they need to be able to prove that you know that it's dirty, they meaning the authorities in the American context. And the whole thing is a charade to ensure that they don't know that. So when, in fact, all these cases that are brought by the United States United States attorneys, that they're all, most of them, wind up with civil fines, not criminal. These people are operating, we're talking, you said $9 billion, and it's a slap on the wrist. When you look at the way that certain financial crimes are being prosecuted and the way people are being imprisoned, it's almost like, you better be careful about which form of financial crime you're going to commit. I wrote a book about a guy who had a Ponzi scheme, and he did it in a public way that made everyone look ridiculous, and he's doing 20.
Right.
But if you're inside a major institution and you have sophisticated lawyers and transnational operations, and it's very hard to sort of pin down who, what, where, and when, then you're not going to do time. So, you may get a smaller bonus. You may have to not fly private for 6 months.
That sounds like horrible. maybe I'm a little bit naive. So it's basically the calculation that they're making has nothing to do with right or wrong. It's simply what is our risk assessment here? What is our exposure? Is there being enough done on the cartel side to mitigate and minimize our exposure to any charges that we were aware of what this money was? So presumably, they don't just show up and just do this out of the blue. Presumably, there must be some type of contact, right? I mean, there must be that day where the guy walks into the bank and says to the local bank guy, or maybe the regional bank guy, or who knows on what level, what do I need to do for you to feel comfortable with me dropping off the money here? Is that basically it?
Well, no, I don't think that. No, it wouldn't happen like that. Look, there is no international law enforcement agency that's been established to deal with international financial crime. Right? There's nothing. It's like Dodge City in the 1860s. There's no sheriff. You do what you can do. So they would just move it between jurisdictions. You can wire money all over the world with consummate ease. These banks are making fees out of it. They're making fees out of transferring it, holding it, and then managing it. And so, you put some money into a Mexican branch, then it transfers it to wherever it goes, Peru, Switzerland, Cayman Islands, and then it winds up, in the Isle of Wight. I don't know. I mean, the amazing thing to refer to my book, the Octopus book, Sam was wiring $100 to $150 million around the world trying to get in on this magical mystery secret bond market that he was convinced existed. It was actually a fraud. But nobody noticed that, or when they did notice it and freeze the money, Sam was always able to spring it. This was like a transparent fraud. So when you get a really sophisticated version of it with actual banks instead of, Sam's Ponzi scheme hedge fund and, lawyers and, assistant managers and regional managers approving these transactions, it's like a daisy chain where everybody can plausibly say they knew nothing. And so the net effect of it is that the money is legitimized and everybody kind of quote unquote wins. It's business. I mean, money, if there's anything in this world that's lacks morality, it's money.
And there's obviously no impetus to sort of tighten these type of laws, because then that's considered a burden on these financial institutions. And we all know what happens then. They threaten the economy of the world, and everything will fall apart, supposedly, if somehow the burden of proof that when a guy comes in, when a series of representatives from some organization, I mean, like what presumably, I mean, at one point, doesn't like the bank say like, hey, you keep bringing in these boxes that you've specially designed to fit under our counters. What do you guys do for a living? I mean, doesn't
that... they never do. You know, Alan Greenspan, the great, the wise, the legendary Alan Greenspan once said that he thought there should be no fraud regulation in the financial markets because that's something that the markets themselves should sort out, and that fraud, you know, over time, fraudsters will be driven from the market. You know, it fails to appreciate the fact that the market itself is based in many ways on fraud. You know, the idea that you would have a responsibility to figure out the provenance of money just is self-evident, right? You know, we all live that way. The IRS wants to know where we get our money. We get our 1099s and our all that stuff. That doesn't apply to institutions. It doesn't apply to cartel. You know, once you get over a certain amount of money and you can move it within, you know, between countries and wire it around, and you enter into an extra legal black hole.
But even when I went in to open my, I opened up a business account back in the day when I had a bit of entertainment career, and the guy, I can't remember what his name was, I sat down with the bank officer, and he's like, you know, I'm dressed as a little bit of a schlub, and I'm coming in there with a massive check, and he's like, what do you do? I took to be like, are you selling drugs?
And you didn't have your check wasn't massive enough.
Right. That's basically what it is. I mean, they don't, you know, but do these drug cartels, do they even pretend like, yeah, we're in, we export, women's clothing or, corn.
Money laundering, you know, if you go along the Pacific coast of Mexico, and especially in Sinaloa, you'll find these a lot of resorts that are empty, but they're great because they just can pretend that they're full. You know, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on. It's variegated and it's transnational, and you know, it's an industry in itself.
Can you get like really good deals? I mean, if I'm going to take the family on vacation, is that where I want to book?
Let's put it this way: this is the kind of thing I discovered in Mexico, right? So say you're a banker and you are an honest guy and you're raising your kids and you're not interested in being involved in anything criminal. You've done your MBA and here you are. The cartel will come to you and say, we want to transact through you. Now, they'll do it not directly, of course, through a lawyer or through a representative, through a legitimate business. But you can see that something's wrong with this, right?
Right.
Here are your choices. Go to the law enforcement, right, and be dead the next day.
Right.
Refuse to do it, and then be dead the next day, or do it.
Right.
Those are your choices. You know, it's the same for law enforcement. You know, they'll come to law enforcement officers in Mexico and say, you know, we want you on our payroll. You can go to your superior and say, you know, they've tried to corrupt me. You can say no, or you can take it. But the only choice you really have is to take it, because otherwise you're considered an enemy.
And so that's
the tragedy of Mexico, and that's the tragedy of the cartels. That's what corrupting a society really looks like, when you have no choice but to participate.
And the only way to diminish their capacity to do this is to make their revenue source less valuable to them, I guess, which is again back to the idea of legalization.
Well, you know, I think that. You know, I'm not saying that that's the magic potion. I think that it has a good shot of being a really significant factor. But what I would say is that the way to start beginning solving a problem is to be honest about it, to assess the real factors that are at play, and to not hide behind, like, nonsensical misrepresentations and moralizing judgments about marijuana. You know, just say no. How are you ever going to solve Mexico's problems with just say no? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
and Obama knows this. Obama, who was doing blow and smoking dope, I mean, you know, it's one of the great failings of the political system in this country that you can't even, you know, it has to come from the grassroots. It's not going to come from above. You know, it's basically the politicians have got to be forced to recognize this reality. And, you know, it's middle-class families with kids that are getting in criminal trouble. that are agitating, and just pot users, I guess. You know, I mean, it is a terrible situation when you can't even begin to discuss the real issues involved with something as big as the drug wars.
Well, all right, it's well said, and I want to move along to just getting an update on the, because we had the opportunity to have a little dinner the other day, and I wanted to hear. I know that people loved the story of, and we just go backwards a little bit and just recap it for us. This was a story that took place during the Bush administration. Two basically teenagers, right? I think one guy was 19, one was 20, maybe?
What, 22, 23.
Okay.
Two Miami Beach stoners became extremely adept at bidding online for
this is why
contracts.
We cannot legalize marijuana, because then all our all our teenage and young young people will become arms dealers.
Well, I'll tell you what, they lived in a place called the Flamingo, and their pot dealer Raul was just down the hall. So, legal or illegal, these guys had a steady supply. So they became very good at bidding online for federal defense contracts. They specialized in that, and they basically worked obscure, smaller contracts that would not that might fall between the cracks for the Fortune 500 companies. Things like Soviet-style weapons to train special forces. You know, and then the Iraq War broke out, and one of these kids, Ephraim Divaroli is his name, really began to succeed at bidding on these contracts that were posted on a place called FedBizOps. He started to do millions of dollars a year in business supplying helmets and AK-47s, ammunition, and various kinds of related materials to the Iraqi army. And that was an absolute fiasco. Of all the fiascos inside Iraq, maybe the largest, most ridiculous fiasco was the attempt to create an Iraqi army. You know, Vinel Corporation, a division of Northrop Grumman, got the initial contract for $50 million, and they're supposed to stand up 9 battalions, and I think they had like 4 soldiers who were... it was pathetic. So anyway, they profiteered, Divaroli in particular, and then the two got together and partnered, and I'm just actually working on a book about it, as I think you know, Sam. It's been purchased to become a feature film with Todd Phillips of The Hangover fame.
Nice.
Considering it as his next project. That's very funny. Anyway, I'm just writing today. I'm looking at this section of the story where, you know, so in the 2006. In 2007, the insurgency in Afghanistan was really starting to get out of hand, and the Bush administration had been pouring all its resources into Iraq, and they decided that they needed to get serious about Afghanistan, so they were going to try to create an Afghan national army. And so the obvious thing is to not do the same thing you did in Iraq, because it was such a fiasco, to not use private contractors, to not imagine that a couple of stoners in Miami Beach are going to get you the best equipment in a timely fashion.
Oh, okay, so, that's your opinion.
Yeah, so they went to the Russian arms supply company, Rosoboron is its name, and it's like one-stop shopping. You can get everything you need because it's Russian-style arms that the Afghans use. You know, now they've changed over to NATO style, but at the time, and it's cheap and it's one-stop shopping. You know, it's like going to Costco or Walmart. It's like you can get everything there. But then this is what I discovered in the last few weeks. It sort of typifies the way that arms dealing works, especially through the Pentagon. The Russian arms company, Rosoboron, entered into a contract with Iran to maintain its fleet of fighter jets. As a result of that, the Pentagon banned the Russians from selling and doing any business with the American government, which really infuriated Putin, because that company was run by his best buddy from KGB days, and this is like a big contract. This is hundreds of millions of dollars. Instead, the Pentagon decided to post the contract on its website, where it was seen by two young stoners, you know, with their electric bong, volcano bong, sitting in an apartment on the beach, and they bid on this contract, and they bid $298 million, and they win the contract. And, of course, you know, mayhem ensues, and all the kinds of, you know, everything that happened in Iraq that was farcical gets cubed. You know, it's Albanian thugs, it's Almost certainly corruption inside American embassies. It's 50-year-old Chinese ammo being shipped into Kabul. It's a ridiculous investigation by, you know, the Keystone Cops of Pentagon police. It's you know, hopefully it's a story that people are going to enjoy. But it's called Arms and the Dudes, and it's based, it's a Rolling Stone article that I wrote, which really only just touched the surface of what I'm discovering about not only this story, but the whole world of arms dealing and international gun running.
All right. Well, when that book comes out, you got to come on and talk to us about that. And,
totally.
It's a crazy story.
well, you know, and I'm in touch with both guys. One guy's doing 5 years. The other guy got a suspended sentence. And you know, it's one of those stories that sort of that just continues to amaze me. The idea that you would refuse to buy weapons from the Russians, which is just basically a self-defeating policy in Afghanistan, it's kind of amazing, you know?
Well, I mean, it's just also just the whole story is just indicative of, like, you know, we hear so much about how Medicare is rife with fraud. We should cut it. We should get rid of health care for seniors because there's fraud involved in this. Yet we have such an amazingly bloated, even if every dollar was spent wisely on our defense, which is almost impossible to do based upon the amount of money that is being spent. Even if somehow there was a sound premise as to why we would need such a massive defense budget, when you hear stories like this, which are never, of course, you know, we never hear anybody go like, hey, we were buying arms via two guys who were sitting in an apartment in Florida smoking a bong on the web.
Here's the amazing thing to me. The way the New York Times, the Pentagon, the Department of Justice, the Department of State, the way the whole world effectively framed the story was that these two terrible fraudsters were preying on the innocent, God-fearing, competent, well-meaning Pentagon officials that were trying to create, legitimately create an Afghan army, which is just preposterous, but that's how it got played out. Not only in the press, but in the courts. Everything, all the sort of the real evidence related to this case, what really happened, the venality of the officials in the Pentagon and the State Department, the way the embassy ran in Albania, the American embassy in Albania, all of this stuff was put under seal and hidden away. But I have good news for your listeners. I'm doing my best to get it all, and I feel like I might succeed.
I know you have your ways now. We just got a couple of minutes. Give us an update. Last we spoke to you, I think the day that I interviewed you, you had just gotten a call from Sam Israel. He had seen you on CBS from prison. He had seen you on CBS. He was excited that you were on. What's happened since? First off, you sold the book, right? I mean,
Matt Taibbi said, In his review of the book, he said, you know, this time next year there'll be a big fat contract. It's not a big fat contract, but it is a contract with HBO to make it into a movie, and I'm very excited about that.
I love it.
Just a little early for the trumpets on these things, because, you know, lots of stuff gets optioned and not made, but hopefully this one will, as really smart people attached. Sam continues to serve out his sentence. You know, he retains the hope of finding some way to get it reduced or get out sooner. He remains convinced that the bonds that if your listeners might remember, Sam had a $450 million hedge fund, supposedly, that was a Ponzi scheme. And at the height of his fraud, he was sort of had $150 million in cash and $250 million in fraud. And he needed to, like, basically triple his money immediately. So he basically got convinced that there's a secret shadow bond market run by the Federal Reserve. And he flew to Europe and spent many months over there trying to trade into this market. And along the way, he acquired these Federal Reserve notes, which the government claims are frauds. But Sam, to this day, maintains that they're real. And
they were hidden in a cave, right? And some island off of in the West Pacific, right?
In the caves of the Isle of Mindanao, instead of south of the Philippines, which is actually a redoubt for Muslim extremists, the group known as MILF, M-I-L-F.
Weird.
That's really the name of the group. So it's this improbable story about the Japanese plundering China's sovereign wealth and stealing all these bonds from Nanking and hiding them in caves, and it goes on and on from there. It's a story of high intrigue and requires a lot of suspension of disbelief, but Sam maintains that there's some truth to this. I'm agnostic about it. I will say, though, that I think that 20 years, in the same way that HSBC's fines are, you know, ridiculously small, and there's no criminal consequences for this massive criminal conspiracy, I think Sam's 20 years for a financial crime is equally preposterous in its overreach. He's not a violent guy, although he does confess to some violence in the story. You know, he's not a threat to anybody. He's just wasting people's money and energy. But anyway, Sam maintains good spirits. You know, he's still himself, and I was on the phone with his former girlfriend, Deb Ryan, just yesterday, and she's back to her business. And, you know, the kind of fraud that Sam perpetuated, not the Ponzi schemes, good Lord, I'm sure that they continue to proliferate, many most uncaught. And also the fraud that Sam got caught up in, this prime bank fraud, continues to be perpetrated on a global scale. It's a sort of like the evil twin of the fraud of Wall Street. You know, it's like this is the real transparently fraudulent conduct. So, you know, the book has had a nice life. It's coming out in France and China soon. And
I will no doubt read it in every language that it comes out.
Well, and I'm actually attempting to do some social media if anybody's interested. I'm up on Facebook.
Yeah, Guy is learning Twitter.
I'm trying to learn Twitter. You could be like my 95th twatter, whatever it is. I'm trying to figure it out, Sam. Inspired by you, in no small part.
I told him you got to get on. You got to do. This is what it takes these days to get out there and spread the word. All right. Sam Israel's around my age. Is that right? He's in the mid 40s.
No, he's a little old. He's 52.
But the story must have taken place when he was in his mid 40s.
Yeah, it's a great time in life. It's like it's the time of crisis.
Let me leave you with this.
Yeah.
Available. You're going to be looking to cast a lead, a Sam Israel? They just say available. Guy had some father issues. I can find that.
I know your father, and I understand that. I think you'd be perfect. But I thought you were going to be occupied with the Mark Green for mayor.
I'm going out. I'm starting a campaign to draft him. If he's not going to run, I'm going to demand that Mark Green runs for mayor.
I love it, Sam. I love it. It's always fun to come on, man.
All right, Guy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
All right. Guy Lawson, everybody. We'll put a link up, obviously, to Octopus. You can tweet him and see if he can figure out how to. I think, what is it, Guy Lawson 2? Is it Guy Lawson 2? Is his Guy Lawson 2? Apparently, someone got there before he did. The original Guy Lawson.
The
Guy Lawson out there. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back with the better half of our program, we're going to talk about this piece that annoyed me. I'll tell you what happened last night. I turned on Current just to see what was going on with Current with the news that it was being sold to Al Jazeera America. And I turn it on, and it's not there anymore. They're not the Time Warner, apparently, he kicked it off. So I ended up watching at one point MSNBC, and I think it was Lawrence I ended up watching. He was talking about how the president won or whatever it is. And the analysis of this whole fiscal cliff deal is just so flat. Sort of, you know, a lot of it we spoke with Ryan Grimm, but, there's a message being pushed here by those people who are close to the White House, who have White House sources. You know, Ezra Klein wrote a piece, Calm Down, Liberals, the White House won. I don't even know how to. What does that even mean? Matt Iglesias had a piece that was basically saying, actually, it was great. He said, I think the headline is 180% wrong. It should be calmed down, liberals. The White House lost. Because the White House agenda is not one that necessarily aligns with a liberal one. But we'll talk about that in the better half of the program. We'll also talk about the current thing. I don't really know any more than anybody else, frankly. But I do have some perspectives on the on that company in some respects. And I don't know, maybe, I don't know, I probably should keep my mouth shut. But I probably won't. All right, so you can join the program, 646-257-3920. Folks, it is your membership that supports this program. And makes me less hesitant to burn bridges, which apparently, at least I'm going to do it in the better half. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can become a member of this program at majority.fm/become a member. You can support the program by sending our Facebook stuff to your friends, subscribing to our YouTube channel, following us on Twitter, buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. JustCoffee.coop continues to make fantastic, fair trade, employee-owned company coffee, organic tea and chocolate if you want it. Check it out. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% discount. See you in the better half of the program.